KALW.
People are tired of insiders. It's a thing in SF and nationally. People are tired of politicians.
Is a fresh candidate more appealing than a seated politician?
As we've talked to consultants and strategists all year, this is the year for an incumbent to lose. You know, if one were to lose, it would be this year.
Today, we hear why London Breed's re-election bid for San Francisco mayor may be vulnerable to an upset. Then, just in time for dress-up season, we explore the joy of transforming into iconic characters.
There's something in cosplay for everyone. Like I said, doesn't matter your age, race, gender, go for it.
And we'll revisit one of our local haunts.
This is where the bodies used to be.
Yeah.
Character embodiment and where the bodies are buried. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Money in San Francisco politics can be messy. If it's not questionable contributions from wealthy donors and special interests, it's scandals around mismanagement and allegations of cash grabs at City Hall. This year's mayoral race is no exception. So who's got the money? Who doesn't? Where's it coming from? And how many votes will it bring in? Mission Local's senior editor Joe Rivano Barros has been following the money. KLW's Sunni Khalid sat down with him to learn more. Here's Sunni.
We have five major candidates. London Breed has been under a lot of criticism recently, naturally, for the state of the city. Do you see this having any impact on the race?
In San Francisco, we have seen huge voter dissatisfaction and a sort of voter revolt. People are fed up with the state of the city, and that is rightly or wrongly laid at her feet. And, you know, in particular, the last few weeks, we've seen a lot of scandals from the Breed administration. I mean, there's been several scandals related to nonprofit contracting. The school district closure fiasco can't be laid at her feet, but she was late to address it. And anyway, it is a sign of general dysfunction in the city, which, again, voters might rightly or wrongly lay at the feet of the incumbent mayor.
Well, it seems like there's been a lot of sniping at Mark Farrell, especially by some of the former mayors, for example. They've all taken aim at his campaign. Do you see that as telling?
There has been a lot of questions raised about his campaign spending, about past unethical dealings, perhaps. And like you mentioned, former mayor signed a letter asking for criminal investigation into his campaign. That may be behind a lot of the slip in the polling numbers that we've seen from Farrell. Voters, again, rightly or wrongly, seeing his campaign as mirrored in these controversies about double dipping and campaign spending and kind of a loan in which he didn't disclose, a six-figure loan from a wealthy family that would come due during his time as mayor. I mean, these things are basic and they all raise questions about, you know, if you're conducting yourself as a candidate this way, how would you conduct yourself as mayor?
And then, of course, there's Dan Lurie, who is sort of portraying himself as the white knight coming to clean up the city. How is that resonating?
A bit of our Gotham Batman and a billionaire heir, no less. It seems to be resonating very well for him. I mean, you know, his strategy has been to buy name recognition, and he has certainly done that. I mean, now people seem to know who Lurie is. He has flooded the zone with campaign ads, flooded billboards, TVs, radio waves. He has poured some $8 million of his own money into the election, into his campaign, plus another $1 million from his mother, and then many millions more from other wealthy donors. And it's worked. He has name recognition. He doesn't have any major scandals. He is planning on reaping those second place votes. I mean, like you said, people see him as an agreeable candidate. And again, people are tired of insiders. It's a thing in SF and nationally. People are tired of politicians, and that seems to be working to his advantage.
Well, isn't Aaron Peskin the consummate insider outsider, the most left-leaning of all of the mayoral candidates?
Yeah, I mean, he's the progressive standard bearer. And like you said, he's been a city hall for two decades plus. He knows the city like the back of his hand. I mean, he could school any one of the other candidates on kind of the arcan of City Hall, but he is an outsider. He is the progressive candidate. He is far and away leading in terms of grassroots small dollar donations, but behind in big donations, which tells you something about where his support comes from. I mean, it tends to come from ordinary folks, and that's reflected in he's lower down in the money race overall, but more of that comes from small dollar amounts. We'll see if it works. I mean, again, he is sticking in it. So he is pulled up ahead of Safai and Farrell, if the most recent polling is to be believed. All of these are still extremely close, though. I mean, within margin of error in some cases, which means that it's essentially a tie. And there are still 2 weeks left to go, and we'll see a lot of spending in these last 2 weeks. And there are still a double digit of undecided voters, which could sway the election.
Well, Joe, you know that this is my favorite part of our segment. Your predictions, who comes in first and second, and who eventually triumphs?
Oh, boy. God, I hate making predictions because inevitably I think it's a fool's errand. You know, I think that earlier I would have said Breed, it was still Breed's to lose. I think Daniel Lurie has a very good shot of winning this thing, if the polls are to be believed. I think he could coast to victory there with Breed not far behind. But again, I mean, I really do believe these last 2 weeks will make a difference. And some voters are undecided and some voters are undercounted. I mean, it's still Heskin, Lurie, Breed, maybe even Farrell. Those are the candidates to watch.
Is there any one constituency that you're looking at that could tip this?
This is the thing about a race this close, is that every constituency matters. So from the beginning, you know, the third of the city that's Chinese, those voters, everyone's made a huge grab for Asian voters. Latino voters a bit less so, because they vote a little less. You know, Republicans, even though they're a very small part of the city, they could end up making the difference because every single vote counts. And it's hard to, you know, at the end of this, we'll say, oh, it was that, it was this or the other. But the reality is it could have been any one of those.
That was Joe Rivano-Barros, senior editor at Mission Local, speaking with KLW's Sunni Khalid. You can hear more about money in local politics on our elections page. That's klw.org/2024elections. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. On most days, Bay Area resident Bill Burns is a sign artist. But on other days, he can be J. Jonah Jameson, Spider-Man's short-tempered editor, or the Star Wars villain Count Dooku. And he's not in costume because Halloween is around the corner. Bill is also a cosplayer. In 2022, he went viral for performing a very realistic Walt Disney at Disneyland. Bill has been dressing up in costumes as a hobby since he was a kid, and now at 61 years old, he continues to bring a lot of people joy embodying characters. KLW's Janae Darden asked him how it feels to be somebody else.
Bill Burns, welcome.
Thank you.
I've been following you on Instagram, and I just love your cosplays. You are so creative. So in 2022, you went viral for walking around Disneyland dressed up as Walt Disney. And let me just say, your Walt Disney cosplay is both amazing and eerie, because I've seen pictures side by side, and I can't tell. You just nailed it. What even gave you the idea to dress up as him? Like, could you see in your face that you resembled him?
In 2016, my wife and I were at a Goofy's Kitchen, which is the character meal. You go there and the characters are running around and whatnot. And Pluto came up behind me and we took a picture together. And the smile that I gave in the picture, I don't usually smile with an open mouth. I just kind of grin or whatever, because I have the mustache and everything. So, but in this picture, I'm smiling with my top teeth showing and everything. And my wife shows me the picture, and I looked at it and I said, "Who does that look like?" And my wife looks at it and she goes, "That looks like Pluto's boss." So I kind of messed around with my hair, and I tried different smiles in the mirror, and I found pictures of Walt. And then I'm like, well, let's buy a nice suit and see if we can do this. And I rolled him out, I think it was fall of 2021. And we got some pretty good responses, and people were getting a lot of double takes and everything.
Amazing. Because it went viral, did Disney reach out to you?
The viral video was actually an accident. We didn't film that. There's a place in the main street where you take pictures with all the characters. And at the time, it was like the third time we had brought Walt out. And we'd never gotten a picture with Mickey Mouse. And so we finally found Mickey, and we go over and we're standing in line. And the cast member who was running the line, he has his clipboard and he's looking down, and he walks over and he goes, well, we're going to cut off the line. And he looks up and he goes, oh. And he says, he pulls me aside and he says, wait here, we'll have Mickey come over to you. And so Mickey comes over, and you saw what happened in the video. We got our pictures taken. And we got happily on our way. And a friend of ours texts us, she's kind of a media manager for us. She takes a lot of pictures and stuff like that. And she texts us and she said, what did you guys do? I said, we haven't done anything. So there's a video up there. It's got a million views right now. And we're like, we didn't take it. So we finally contacted the person that took it, and she gave us a copy. And that's, you know, throughout the rest of the day, it was getting 2 million, 3 million, 4 million views, and it just kept going and going and going, and it exploded. The guests in the park want to believe that's Walt. The magic just happens around for them, that this is the spirit, or, you know, of Walt Disney. And I'm sure they see the smiles and the happiness and the picture taking and the tears that, you know, I can't explain it any more than that. It's just, it got so huge. I have people who met Walt in the park when they were children, and they're coming up to me in tears, and they just want to hug, or they just want to hold hands and tell me about when they first saw Walt as children. It's just incredible.
Wow. Yeah, what you're saying reminds me of Stan Lee and Spider-Man comic, where he says, with great power comes, I think, great responsibility. Which leads me to another character that you play, which is Peter Parker's editor, J. Yeah. Jonah Jameson, yeah. Who is completely opposite in character and energy and personality as Walt Disney. Yeah. He is the cranky, very cranky, jaded news editor. And I love that character because I've worked with That's a true character. I've worked with people like that. And it's they remind me of some of my journalism school professors. I was like, oh, Jay Jemison really does exist. And when you, and I've seen videos when you cosplay him, you're not just walking around dressed like him. You are animated and acting like him.
Yes. I go full JJ on people. JJ is kind of my therapy character. Because, it, like you said, with Walt, it's night and day with these two characters. But when you dress as J. Jonah Jameson and people see that character, they expect a response. You cannot dress like that character and say, oh, hi, everyone. How you doing? That's not going to sell it. They expect a response. When you have a Spider-Man or a Spider-Verse cosplayer come up to you and say, Jay Jonah, say something. You know, say something to me. Tell me I'm horrible. You're horrible. You're a moron. You're an idiot. Get out of here. And they run away screaming and laughing. They love it. It's so bizarre.
So, Bill, you know, you are a gentleman of a certain age.
Yeah.
And often when people talk about cosplaying, they think of younger generations doing this. But here you are, out here creating really amazing looks. I mean, just literally, like, you know, recreating these people. Recreating characters, reinventing, you know, characters. And I always believe in feeding your inner child and just letting the inner child come out and have fun. So what would you tell someone who wants to do this, but they're hesitant because they're not 21, they're not 31?
I would tell them cosplay is a very, very big, wide world out there. There are so many characters, pop culture, from comic books, movies, you name it. I'm 61, I'll just say it. And I do stay in that range because there's no way I'm going to be doing any of the younger Captain America, Spider-Man. You're not, spandex ain't happening here. Sorry. Okay. It's not going to happen. Or I would tell this person, you can play this character, but what if you played a version of this character as of that certain age? I saw a woman play Wonder Woman, and she was in her 70s. And she looked amazing. Like, what if Wonder Woman aged? This is what she would look like. Never be hesitant to do it, because there's something in cosplay for everyone. Like I said, doesn't matter your age, race, gender, doesn't matter. Go for it.
That was cosplayer Bill Burns speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. You can hear more from their conversation and find links to Bill's cosplay at klw.org/crosscurrents. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Okay, since we've been talking about dressing up and becoming different characters, let's lean into the season with a good ghost story. In the late 1800s, San Francisco started to get crowded. To make more room, the city outlawed burials, and it moved all of its cemeteries south to Colma. The business of funerals, however, stayed in San Francisco. The Southern Pacific Railroad cut through the Mission on its way to Colma, and so new mortuaries started opening up along Valencia Street, including in the building that's now the chapel. Today, the chapel is a lively music venue, but many people who work there say its history as a mortuary lingers. Reporter Zoe Ferrigno has the story.
It's a quiet afternoon at the chapel. The bar hasn't opened yet, and I'm standing in between the kitchen and the patio, looking up at a big, rusty piece of metal on a wall. It looks like it could be an old wagon spoke or just a weird piece of art, but in reality...
That's the crank right there, where they used to hoist the bodies up after they went through the proper process to be buried. They would be hoisted up using this crank.
Paul Chalker handles PR for the chapel, and he's giving me a tour of the building. He says where we're standing right now used to be a garage where bodies were loaded onto the train. Joining us is former chapel bartender Javi Castro. He leads us down a flight of stairs into the basement wine cellar. It's small, cold, and pitch black.
And then at 2:30 in the morning, nobody else here. Super dead quiet. You'd never ever want to be here more than 10 seconds.
This is where the bodies used to be.
Yeah.
Javi says when he first started working at the chapel, some guys on the cleaning crew told him they thought the building was haunted. After an experience down here in the cellar, Javi became a believer.
The door just slammed shut on me. And I opened the doors, nobody there. And then I got super, super spooked, like all this weird, like energy up my spine. I was just like, I knew I was not alone at that time. And that's when it started. I was like, all right, this is for real.
After that night, Javi says he'd often see figures out of the corner of his eye, but they'd vanish when he turned to get a better look. It was like something was there, but always just out of view. But for others, the presence of something ghostly has been a little less subtle.
I would be in the kitchen really, really early in the morning, and there would be nobody else in that building.
Elaine Osuna is a chef who helped open the chapel. She tells me that she would often see the shadowy figure of a woman in a hallway by the kitchen.
No, she has, or she, it's like she's in like a white dress, and her hair is in a way, like I can see how she's styled, like her hair is in a way kind of like an old-fashioned bun.
Elaine noticed something else unique about the woman.
The smell of roses was always with her.
Elaine called her the Rose Lady.
You're gonna think I'm nuts, but I always felt like she was kind of keeping me company. And so I know it sounds nutty, but she kind of made me feel like I wasn't by myself in a good way.
But if Elaine is nuts, so is everyone I talk to at the chapel.
there was a shelf, like a metal shelf with all sorts of beer bottles on it. And one time a bottle just basically shot straight at me, like horizontally off the shelf, and then just stopped in midair and just dropped to the ground.
That's former barback Rick Altieri. And here's Erica Wesley. She manages the venue's box office.
I've seen things in the bathrooms, like kind of like shadowy figures. Like it's usually standing behind me, and like when I look in the mirror, it's like behind me. One time I had someone tap me on the shoulder, and there was no one there.
It turns out, though, that sometimes the creepiest things happened at the chapel when no one was around to see them. A few years ago, one of the security cameras captured something late at night. You can look the video up online. In it, you can see the area where the old body crank is. The last member of the cleaning crew leaves, and all of a sudden, a little girl appears, wearing a white dress and no shoes. She darts into the room and then runs back out. Erica was one of the first people to see the video.
And when we went back through all the footage, we looked at every camera the entire night, and there's nobody there that's wearing anything like that. There was another camera that would have picked up her movements once she left, and that camera shows nothing.
After news of the video spread, more people came forward, sharing sightings of the girl. People at the chapel started calling her Valencia, after the street. I ask a few people whether they're sure Valencia is really a ghost, or if there might be another explanation. But everyone seems convinced. As Erica told me, when it comes to believing in ghost stories, the chapel is a pretty persuasive place.
I don't know, man, it's turned people. Like, we've had people that work there that don't believe in ghosts at all. You know, people that are in their 20s and 30s and have never believed in any of that stuff.
But after working at the chapel, now they're believers. On Valencia Street, I'm Zoe Ferrigno for Cross Currents.
Zoe reported that story in 2018. Listen to more scary but true stories at klw.org/crosscurrents. That's if you dare. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. After Halloween, there's another holiday coming up. Friday marks the beginning of Diwali. It's a 5-day festival that's all about celebrating the triumph of light over darkness and good over evil. Millions of people celebrate around the world, and today we're bringing you an excerpt of Sandhya Dirk's 2015 story to hear how Diwali is done in the Bay. This is Diwali, India's biggest festival, and there's a lot going on. I'll let my mother, Leela Wood, explain.
This is sort of the culmination of the festival season.
Diwali.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the end of all the festivals.
Yeah, it's a festival. It's like a New Year's festival. It's a festival of light and beginnings and auspiciousness.
That word, auspiciousness? It's probably a pretty fair giveaway that my mom didn't grow up here. She was born in Bombay, now Mumbai, and she's been back in India for a while now. But this month, she's visiting me. Poor mom, all she wants to do is eat burgers and watch American TV. And I've brought her here to watch a small parade of South Asians in costume, chanting and pushing around statues of gods and goddesses on elaborate platforms, round and round.
So they're just... they're basically just going around in circles?
But that's India. We go around in circles.
Diwali marks the end of the circle of the year, the finish and rebirth of a cycle of festivals celebrating gods and goddesses from Ram to Kali to Ganesha. Diwali is quite literally the festival to end all festivals. Think New Year's plus the 4th of July multiplied by Bollywood.
But I do want to tell you one more time that the fireworks and the laser show will start sharp at 8 o'clock.
Sandhya Dirks reported that story in 2015 as part of our series, Audiographs. Hear the full story at klw.org/crosscurrents. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11. We'll meet a florist who grows marigold flowers for Dia de los Muertos.
It's a very humble plant. When I smell it, I close my eyes, and when I smell it, I can smell like a fresh rain. I can smell like a farm. I smell the earth.
Fresh flowers for ancestor altars. That's tomorrow morning at 11. Today's Cross Currents team includes Demetrius Johnson, Leon Morimoto, Crystal Rahim, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salier, Shireen Adil, Hanisha Harjani, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.